You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Emily and Alex.
Hi there, Bob.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing? I mean, all things considered, given the fact that the world itself is going to hell.
What is it they say in Norway? Awaken, not crying?
I don't know, but you know, they're in trouble because there's somebody they failed to give the Nobel Peace Prize to, and that was a big mistake, apparently. Okay, enough of that. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Emily Bender and Alex Hanna, and you are, among other things, co-hosts of a podcast about AI called Mystery AI Hype Theater 3000. And if people are looking for an AI podcast that's different from the others, this would be a good candidate. You're much more skeptical of the overall AI enterprise than many AI podcast hosts. And that brings us to the book of yours that we're going to talk about that you co-authored called The AI Con, How to Fight Big Tech's Hype and Create the Future We Want. Now, I wish I could hold the book up, but I've been listening to it. So the best I can do is like this. If you have a copy of the actual book, you want to show up, feel free. But there you go.
And of course, we both have the posters in the background.
The poster.
Oh my God. You guys should be marketing consultants. This is exactly the kind of guidance I've needed all my life. Okay. So let me say a little more about each of you. Alex Hanna, you are a sociologist and director of research at the Distributed AI Research Institute. Is that still true?
That is correct. Yeah. Still there.
Okay. And Emily, you are a linguist. You teach at the University of Washington, and you're well known as for being the lead author on a paper that I think coined the term stochastic parrot, certainly popularized it.
We coined it, and it's the paper's actually got co-first authors between me and Dr. Tanit Gebru, but actually I'm the one who coined the phrase.
Okay. And it is, I think it's safe to say is it safe to say it's a pejorative term for large language models? It's certainly a term, a metaphor meant to underscore their limitations as you see them.
Well, for sure. Like, it was meant to be a way to make vivid what it is that this technology does and doesn't do. Mm-hmm. It only becomes pejorative or a slur to people who are highly identified with a different idea of what the tech is.
Oh, no, I didn't mean you were slurring them. I meant you were slurring the LLMs. But then again, you certainly don't think they're sentient, so maybe that...
Right, so an LLM is not the kind of thing that actually can be the target of a slur.
Okay.
Because it's not the kind of thing that can take offense. But there are people who hold other belief systems in which it makes sense for them to characterize this phrase as a slur.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of curious as to how you could ever know for sure whether they are or not sentient, since you can't really know that about any beings other than yourself. But we'll save that philosophical.
We need to get into that, because one of my rules is that I don't have conversations with people who don't posit my humanity as an axiom of the conversation. So I'm going to invite you to believe, for the purpose of this hour, that I have just as much internal life as you do.
I actually already believe that, but I only believe it with 99.999% confidence. You can never be quite sure.
All right. So for this hour, please posit it.
Oh, this is the way I do. I've conducted my whole life under the assumption that I'm not the only sentient being on the planet. Okay, so let's talk about the book. I want to get back to the stochastic parrot metaphor. I have some questions about it. I want to give you a little pushback of a kind that I'm sure you've already gotten about it, and you'll no doubt have something to say in response. But as for the book as a whole, just to situate you on the landscape, in the AI discourse, there are people that are called AI doomers. There are people that you in the book called AI boosters. They have very different views about how worried we should be about the technology, but they agree that it's very powerful and will advance rapidly and become more powerful. You disagree with both schools on that front. However, you, in terms of your level of concern, you're, I guess, a little closer to the doomers, at least in the sense that you have real concerns about the technology. Yeah, it looks like Emily, you wanted to say something or?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a lot to say there, but I think that a lot of the discourse about the discourse frames the boosters and the doomers as sort of the extreme ends of the continuum and says everyone else has to find their position in between. But in fact, as we argue, they're two sides of the same coin, predicated on this idea that AI is a thing, it's inevitable, it's imminent, and then they only diverge on sort of what the implications of that are going to be. And you're right that we have concerns not about anything AI would do, but about what's being done in the name of artificial intelligence. And as people try to chase this fantasy, the harms that are happening to actual people and the planet.
Okay. Alex, anything you want to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, just following on what Emily is saying, I mean, there's a lot more different positions and trying to think about technology. Boosters or doomers really limits it to, I think, I don't even know if it's even one spectrum. It seems like it's maybe one point on a grid, because calling it a spectrum, I think, is limiting, especially when you look at the actors involved. I mean, the people, most of the people that are boosters have some kind of, or rather doomers, often have a booster background or are, you know, you could point in case, you know, case in point, someone like Jeff Hinton, who, you know, was one of the people that was very operational and the resurgence of neural networks as a technology, had spent a lot of the 80s working on neural networks. I just read a bunch of history for this other thing I was working on. And so, but Hinton, you know, after he quit Google in 2024 and, you know, gladly received the Nobel for his work on Boltzmann machines with John Hopfield, still, you know, saying that this is thing that's going to take over the world. You know, we need to code these things with a maternal sensibility, which was bizarre. But, you know, that's, you know, he spent a lot of time working on that. And there's many others who are in the same boat. And so I think that is, I mean, when you're looking at the actors, there's quite a big overlap in the Venn diagram. I think the space is much broader. I mean, the space of people who don't think about AI at all. There's many people like that. But there's also people who have been calling out the harms of automated decision-making systems and automation for quite some time. We can go as far back as the Luddites. We can go more recently to the labor struggles in the 50s and 60s with factory workers. And we can look at the people who are engaged in looking at how automation hurts us in the here and now. And so that can be a pretty broad range of people.
And you don't think Luddite should be a pejorative, which is the way it's most often used, I'd say, right? As people who are just hopelessly out of touch with reality.
Yeah, I mean, the way that it is, I'd say the way that it's used now is a pejorative for people who are unfamiliar with technology, are scared of technology, have a fear of kind of the unknown. And Luddites, as many people have reinscribed and said this and resuscitated this, and there's a long history of people who have tried to remove the besmirching mark or connotation of Ludditism, or rather remove the negative connotation from the word, including David Noble and Brian Merchant and Dathan Sadowski. You know, these are people who are really invested in workplaces that would work for them and are not opposed to technology. I mean, many folks are technologists. I count myself as one of them, but really want it to work for workers and work for people in a way that's actually going to aid them in what they're doing, their work, their labor, their you know, whatever they're trying to do specifically.
Okay. So let me say generally, as a rule, I'm not going to be like calling on either of you. I'll leave it to you to decide who should respond to a given question, and then leave it to you to add something to whatever the other says. So as we've said, you on the one hand have a relatively low estimation of the abilities of AI and its likely pace of advance compared to the other groups we've talked about. On the other hand, you are pretty worried about it. that strikes some people as paradoxical. You know, I had Gary Marcus on a couple of years ago, and he has some of the same, there's some overlap in those regards. And I said to him, you know, it reminds me, your position reminds me of the old joke about the person who says about a restaurant, there are two things I don't like about this place. The food is so bad and the portions are so small. In other words, you know, if the food's so bad, why, you know, why would you want larger portions? And a question I'm sure you're asked is, look, if this stuff isn't powerful, if it's not going to be useful ultimately, or at least not very useful, how likely is it to infiltrate our society so much that it becomes a big risk? So I'm sure you've been asked the question.
Yeah. So this is a bit of a conflation of usefulness and adoption, you know, like, so, and in distinction from someone like Marcus, who, you know, I haven't read much of his work, but the kind of understanding is someone like Gary Marcus wants something to exist that is called AI, but just doesn't agree with the large language model approach, is much more interested in the symbolic logic AI that's tradition. Right. You know, that's a different project than what I would say that we're invested in, which I think is more of the ilk of, we're not against technology, but technology itself, you know, we don't believe in this project of AI. You know, we don't think there this thing of AI, this project, is not something that is a worthwhile technological goal. It makes sense to have technology that is developed with the particular users in mind that support democratic institutions that are governed by people who are most affected by it. But the way that quote unquote AI systems are used in this way, they require huge amounts of data, they require huge amounts of compute, they require all this energy, water, there's all these carbon and air pollutants. And so that's not a good way to go in building technology. And so it is, you know, it's not to say that these, and I guess getting to the original point of usefulness and effect, something can be not useful, but also have tremendous impacts on society. You can have cigarettes, I don't know, maybe have some use and calming someone down. I don't know the effects of nicotine specifically. It's not through non-use. It's just because I don't know the literature on it. But you can also say it's had a huge impact on society. So I mean, you know, you're making some kind of a claim about pervasiveness and then usefulness and social utility.
Nicotine does, in fact, bring people pleasure for understandable chemical reasons, and for that reason, it's addictive, which is a problem because they're bad for you, but it's not like it's in their heads that it makes them, well, it is in a sense, and feel good. But you know what I mean. I mean, there's a reason cigarettes, I mean, some people smoke them to show off or start off that way. But the utility that leads people to buy them in a certain sense is real. I mean, we don't need to get off. Let me ask you, and I know you want to jump in, Emily, but let me just set it up. Let's keep talking about this. Let me set it up this way. So, in the book you write, you list some claims about AI, and you write, this is, of course, all bullshit. AI isn't sentient. It's not going to make your job easier, and AI doctors aren't going to cure what ails you. Now, my own experience with it as a work assistant and in the medical realm lead me to, I mean, it may not exactly cure what ails me, but it's been useful. But the, in particular, you say it's not going to make your job easier. I mean, I guarantee you, if by easier you mean you can either do the same amount of work in less time or spend the same amount of time and do a better job. And I'm talking about writing. I'm a journalist writing a piece. It's definitely made it easier. It's not, I refuse to believe that this is an hallucination. I can explain to you what it does for me, but do you mean this statement to be as sweeping as it sounds? It's not going to make anybody.
Yes, we do.
It is not going to make. So all these people who would say what I just said, which is that it saves me time, you think they're just
so
wrong.
So give me a chance to sort of spell it out here a little bit. Okay. I mean, first of all, when we're talking about usefulness, we need to say useful to who, right? The project of artificial intelligence has been extremely useful for management looking to lay people off. But we don't need all these workers anymore because AI is going to do it. That's a kind of usefulness that is completely orthogonal to what's being promised in the marketing to individual people, but it's absolutely what's being promised in the marketing to the managers. So there's that one set of usefulness. And we end up with enormous impacts on society if it's like, oh, we don't have to keep investing in repairing the social safety net because we can just use the useful AI to have individualized tutoring, to have medical care, and so on, right? Mm-hmm. Who is that useful to? Well, ultimately, it's useful to the people who don't want to pay taxes and actually pay their fair share in being in a society. So when we talk about usefulness, I think we need to talk about useful to who.
I would also,
yeah.
No, go ahead, Emily. Finish this statement, because I also wanted to jump into, because I also wanted to, like, specifically.
Can I just, as long as we're on that one
point. Yeah, go ahead.
Let me say, first of all, I'd say those are kind of two different realms, private sector and government. I think companies, as a rule, and this, I don't mean this as a compliment, but I think they're pretty ruthlessly focused on the bottom line. And if it turns out that a technology can't help them produce more at lower cost, then they're not going to use it. Now, in the realm of government.
Okay, I completely disagree with that. I mean, one of the things that we know for our 40 years plus of organizational sociology is that companies are not fully optimized rational actors. Companies operate because they exist within a field of other firms, and they do things because of what other firms do. And so, for instance, one of the things we also say in the book is that, you know, much of the AI hype cycle works because fear of missing out, FOMO. And there is data. I mean, you know, like there was a newspaper report we talked about on our podcast with the Financial Times, given that they used ChatGPT for some of the analysis, which is a little shaky, but
a little shaky,
but I would say even the sort of task of doing classification, which I think is like one of the more narrow tasks, which I'm like, and, you know, having manual review after, you know, gives me a little more confidence in those results, would be that, you know, most of the firms that they analyzed basically were not finding, they basically got involved in adopting quote unquote AI tools because other firms within their sector were doing so. And so it doesn't have to be rational, right?
No,
to
say well, that. And
to actually have adoption on that sense, it can be done so because there are other people that you're worried about that are going to be adopting that. And there will be some kind of payoff in productivity at some time in the future. If that doesn't get realized, then that's kind of a sunk cost. But if it does, then you have this potential to leapfrog the competition.
No, I agree. Especially when a technology is new, there's going to be a lot of like ill-advised experimentation and stuff. I should say where I broadly stand on these issues is I share a lot of your concerns, like impact on employment, concentration of power, like who controls the machines. But the reason I'm so concerned is because I actually think they're powerful. I mean, I think they're going to take a lot of jobs because they can save companies money. And I think
we're not seeing that, though. We really are not. There was, and you know, that we hear over and over again from friends who work in tech that they are being told that it is part of their KPIs, part of what they're being measured on, not how productive are you being, but how much are you using the chatbot. But basically, management has bought into this so much that in order to make it true, they are basically forcing down, like, you have to do this, you have to do this. And there's both sort of in the moment, we need to also, I think, disaggregate. Like, I cringe every time you are putting words in my mouth about AI and it, because I never refer to artificial intelligence as if it were a thing. There's a range of technologies. Large language models, probably useful for code completion, which is distinct from vibe coding, which is distinct from, you know, modeling protein folding, which is most distinct from playing chess, which is distinct from taking multiple choice exams, which is like, why do we need to automate taking multiple choice exams? But anyway, that keeps happening. And to sort of say, yes, there are places where automation is helpful. And so therefore, ChatGPT is going to take over the world is missing what's actually happening.
So where is it helpful? Where do you think it's helpful?
What do you mean by it?
Well, whatever kind of whatever form of helpfulness is provided by the technology that is sometimes broadly referred to as AI, that's the kind I'm talking about. So if you're talking about, like, you know, what
are you specifically talking about LLMs? And what does, I guess it's useful in LLMs. And I think that's, so let's take this as an example. Like, one of the things that, you know, I'm willing to sort of, like, go ahead and make this concrete. So let's talk about you as an independent journalist. As an independent mm-hmm. journalist, someone that has written multiple books, someone that has, a Substack with many subscribers. In the case of writing or structuring a technology in, you know, like an LLM, may be useful insofar as structuring your blog post and then doing the verification after that to ensure that everything is in accordance with what you would want to say. That is a specific...
To be clear, I don't use it to structure writing or to do writing.
I don't know what you use it for.
But there are other things, including verification and other things.
Okay. I was making an assumption.
You're using ChatGPT to verify something?
Well, I'm more inclined to use Perplexity because it includes links, but I would say all of them are more and more inclined to include actual links to sources. But actually, not just verification. The most valuable thing is actually the research phase, and ultimately you can use it to find the actual sources. So
I'm saying, do you always go back to the actual sources, or do you ever take just what comes out of Perplexity?
Yeah, I go back to the sources. If I'm going to report a fact or a quote or something like that, yeah.
Okay, good. Because I was going to say, otherwise you're not doing journalism if you are not going back to the original sources, because these things make paper mache out of their input. And yes, sometimes a link comes out and it might be an effective way to get to that link for you. But so you're talking about the use case of basically a search engine. It's a search engine that allows you to use more natural language rather than keywords. It's a search mm-hmm. engine that maybe does an end run around some of the incentivization of search, right? I mean, Google's product was made worse on purpose by Google so that more people would spend more time on it, so they would see more ads. Right? So it is possible that you are finding usefulness in the chatbots as search engines, although I have a lot to say about why that's not a good idea in general.
I'm curious, why is it not a good idea?
So most people who use a chatbot as a search engine are not going to actually use it as a search engine. They're going to use it as an answer engine. Mm-hmm. They're not going to drill down and look at the sources. And so they're not going to see how those answers are located in the information ecosystem and how the sources speak to each other. As a trained journalist, I'm willing to believe that you are above that and that you always go to the source, but the average user doesn't. And then on top of that, you're talking about systems that are environmentally ruinous. You're talking about systems that are built on labor exploitation, and you're talking about systems that are built on data theft. So to the extent that you are getting value out of that compared to the old-fashioned search engine, compared to connecting with people and asking questions, that value is coming not for free and not for whatever your monthly fee is, but actually at a very large cost to society.
Well, it depends. I mean, I agree that the power consumption is a problem, and I hope the boosters are right that it's going to miraculously figure out a way to solve climate change. You know, the water issue is increasingly kind of disputed, but we didn't need to get off on that. I mean, I haven't done the moral assessment of whether whatever damage I'm doing is worth it. I'm just arguing that if you say it's not useful at all to workers, which you pretty much assert,
the data is also there, where productivity is not the kind of productivity gains which are being attributed the kinds of empirics that we're seeing that are coming out are pretty dismal on it. I mean, when we're seeing, there's a few different types of things. In cases that are either laboratory studies on, let's say, coding, because I think it's important to center what the actual task is and to be mm-hmm. specific about what we're talking about. Laboratory experiments around productivity have shown an increase, and that's typically if it's a greenfield task. So by greenfield task, I'm saying it says, write a bubble sort, you know, from scratch or whatever. Not to say, you know, forget all that stuff about whether there's a bubble sort in the training data. Probably is. Probably millions of them in the training data and whatnot. Now, using it in production, however, the data's not there. Using it in production, mm-hmm. we're not really seeing that. There was a study that I haven't seen really much response to, kind of disproving by METR, where they were looking at developers working in situ in existing GitHub issues. And that study, they effectively found that developers thought they were saving time with using not just ChatGPT, using tools like Cursor that it meant for coding, but actually they thought they were saving time, but it's actually taking them more time. And they were verifying this with screenshots and recording what they were doing. And let me finish. So one of the things, that's one part of this. So there's the productivity myth, which is a myth, you know, and I can assert them, but I'm not just asserting them, because this is what happens with all technology. All technology will be, you know, that comes in, that promises automation, can also then, we know from the history of technology that these do not magically solve work tasks, you know, and that is something that has borne out in different histories. And there's a book one of my colleagues has been talking about. It's called, it's a book by a historian about kind of like, that's talking about automation in car manufacturing. And I mean, so we're seeing this story quite over and over again. The other part where I do want to focus on...
But you would agree that automation has increased efficiency of production over time, right?
I didn't agree with that. No, I didn't. You're asking me to assert that.
I'm just asking. So you're saying
you're asking me to agree with something that you said. I wanted to get back to this question of usefulness. I'm not saying that automation hasn't increased productivity. However, productivity is defined in terms of however economists define productivity. Yeah, I mean that has increased. I mean, productivity as productivity as labor economists have defined it, as factor productivity, as yielding more outputs based on declining inputs, has increased across time. That now you cannot, that is true, but I'm not willing to grant that happens solely due to technology. And any labor economist worth their salt shouldn't either, right? And so the other part that I also want to discuss is that, let's get back to this idea of useful. I think talking about usefulness makes sense for you as an independent journalist. Most people aren't independent journalists. Most people actually have, you know, quite large management structures. Most people have to either report AI usage or whatever large language model usage to a manager, and are being assessed to that end. And if that's the case, that changed the calculus in terms of what's considered useful. It may be useful for a particular sort of task if someone has quite a lot of control over one's workplace, but for people, especially people who are in junior roles or have for the large amount of people that don't have control over their workplaces, it is or has made their jobs worse. And we see this. We've seen this.
Well, it's made my job worse too, in a way.
Well, yeah, it's made your job worse because we're yelling at you.
No, but I mean, in the sense that everyone else is using it, and so there's more content being produced faster that competes with mine, and I don't want to. Well, there's a lot of ways I don't want to create content. So I'm not denying that. I'm not saying, again, I'm not like a booster. I'm very concerned about the technology, but my concerns grow out of the belief that actually it's very powerful. And quickly on the productivity thing, just a couple of things. First of all, I have a pet theory. I mean, it's early days, you know, in terms of productivity actually showing up. I have a pet theory about one thing that's going on, which is I think a lot of workers are just kind of using it. I don't mean on the sly, but they're using it to save themselves time. And that doesn't show up in productivity stats. In other words, they keep giving their boss the same amount of product and they can goof off a little more. I think some of that is happening. That's what I'd do if I were them. And so that's not showing up. But I also just think it's early days and people are trying bad products and it'll take a while. But on the coding front, I would say, look, I'm not a coder, but and I'm familiar with a meter study that some months ago found that coders were overestimating the benefits it was giving them. And in fact, wasn't helping them at all. But I will say, it seems that even just within the last 3 months, everyone who is a coder says there have been these radical advances, especially as reflected in Claude code. And I don't know, maybe they're all wrong, but I will say for sure something you can do now is say, create me a website that has X, Y, and Z properties, you know, and it does it apparently. And that's something just wasn't doable 3 years ago.
I've got some stuff to say there. First of all, you say everyone who is a coder says this. That's bullshit. I'm sorry, you haven't talked to every single software engineer out there. Yes, there's a lot of people out there who like beating this drum. There's a lot of people out there who were reserving judgment and then became impressed in the last 3 months. I'll grant you that. Mm-hmm. But it is not mm-hmm. true that you have unanimity among coders that all of a sudden true. This thing
that
is
was
doing
an exaggeration if I said yeah. everybody. Yes,
you did. It's been recorded. And also, I'm a linguist.
We'll cut,
so I'm
we'll cut that part
things.
Out. We'll cut that part out. And this will look like a false accusation on your part. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, I've got my own local recording. But more to the point, the vibe coding that you're talking about, give me a website, is exactly the kind of thing that appeals to managers. Because yeah. you can get a prototype really fast, but that prototype is flimsy. That prototype doesn't have what you need to actually build out into something good and stable and usable and secure. All right. So the managers are being sold this fantasy that the things that the people who actually do the work say take a long time can now be done immediately. And oh, look, it's so pretty. And in fact, Ali Al-Khatib makes a good point that you want prototypes to look shaky. You don't want them to look polished, because if they look polished, it is sending mixed signals about actually how close the thing is to usable. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, Emily,
can I say something?
Yeah, go ahead,
I am a coder. I have a degree in computer science and mathematics, right? And I mean, I haven't done a survey of all coders, you know, but I also know that I have a lot of people that I went to school with who are, and I know a lot of people are, you know, very, very hesitant to use the tools. Also, because doing something like, okay, write me a website, that's a very well-defined task. There's probably a website, standing up a website in your, you know, particular web framework, whatever, React, you know, Flask, whatever, you know, I wrote, my dissertation is a couple thousand lines of Flask code, you know, like that's using an MVC framework, like all these are pretty well articulated types of coding tasks. And because, you know, for instance, Microsoft has access to GitHub's code base, then lots of that's being ingested for production. If you're thinking about what the majority of software engineering is, it is maintenance. It is maintenance of existing code. It is maintenance of the old code bases and C++ in legacy systems. And God forbid you have to write anything in COBOL. If you're writing anything in those languages, which the US government basically is all written, you know, and is a lot of it is written in legacy architecture like COBOL, then you're going to be really SOL. And so if you have a different vision of what software engineering is, then that is a very different task. I mean, I'm going to take one sample. I ran into a guy on a plane who literally works in hardware design for machine learning systems on a plane. And I was like, well, what do you do? He's like, oh, I do this. And he works in these frameworks that they have at Google. And I was like, oh, do you use these tools? He's like, no, not really. I try to ask it to like write some code, and it did such a terrible job. And he's like, I don't know, but people seem to like it. And I'm like, okay, you know, and anybody that's doing anything that has a modicum of more complicated things than standing up a minimal viable product will tell you it's not suitable for that.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this. So is it that you're not very concerned about the long-term impacts on employment, or you actually think that corporations will remain confused about how much productivity they're getting. So it will have bad effects on employment.
Yes, it already has, right? And I mean, the kind of layoffs that we're seeing are a consequence of employers thinking that it will actually lead to these productivity gains. Much of the time, what's happening is that employers are shifting their money that they have from headcount to investment in these tools, or doing some kind of skilling around them, or putting, or just doing seeding other, you know, like seeding investments. So this happened with Amazon effectively. Amazon a couple months ago laid off, initially said, was reported they were going to lay off about 30,000 people. They laid off something close to 14,000. Amazon, you know, could have said, we're doing this because AI is more effective. But they ended up saying, Andy Jassy, CEO, said, we're doing it because we're restructuring middle management and we want to look into kind of moving things into AI investment, but did not say that, did not make the productivity case, right? And this is Amazon, right? This is Amazon in which they have, you know, now a performance review requirement to say that you have to be using an LLM, you know, X amount of the time. And so the kind of layoffs that we have is more of a shifting of capital. It's moving to justify on the big tech firms, justifying capital expenditure or investment in tools. But we're not seeing this kind of productivity boon that we expected.
But you're assuming he's telling the truth? Because I would think that given how big Amazon is
why wouldn't he tell the truth there?
Because he's part of the AI hype machine. He doesn't want to emphasize the downside of AI.
You haven't understood what Alex is saying.
What I'm saying is that it would behoove him to hype it up and say that, look, we were able to replace 14,000 jobs because this AI tool that we've been using is so good. And why wouldn't he? I mean, he directs people are buying more AI. Benefits Amazon because they're the ones with the data centers and they're spinning up all the, I mean, they're not primarily model builders, but they are the people who are providing so much of the hardware and the data center build out just through their existing cloud business. So if that's to happen, it does behoove Jassy to make that argument.
Yeah, I mean, I think their ideal PR world is to say it does increase productivity, but not talk about the other side of the coin, which is massive layoff. I don't think they want AI associated with massive layoff.
Oh, they absolutely do. They absolutely do. Because here's the thing, even more cynically than what Alex is saying, they don't have to believe it's helping so long as it provides an excuse to lay people off because that juices the stock price. Right. And it's all very short term driven. Can you reduce costs in the short term? Then the stock market's going to reward you. Right. It's not, as I was saying before, these are not rational actors.
They're doing that in any event. I mean, they are cutting the jobs.
Exactly.
Regardless of how they spend it.
But, yeah. And we're also seeing, so Alex found this stat recently that the most, in quotes, popular job on LinkedIn over some period of time was data annotator. Was that the title, Alex?
No, there was actually a LinkedIn post. I think it was the most posted job.
Yeah.
This was look at this. It was of the 15 most posted jobs. Now I'm looking at LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. But like of the 15 most posted jobs, I think the fourth one was data annotator or data trainer, something effectively of like people who are correcting the outputs of these technologies. Or providing inputs to them.
So and companies have taken relatively stable jobs and basically pulverized them into all of these tiny little gig work, you know, human intelligence tasks, to take the Amazon term for it. And yeah, that's going to look good to the stockholders. It sucks for everybody else, right? And it's not more productivity. It's just worse working conditions. And so when we say in the book, in quotes, AI is not going to take your job, it's just going to make it shittier. That's the kind of thing we're talking about.
Yeah. Let me, Emily, I had said I'd ask you about this stochastic parrot metaphor. Let me give you what I assume is a form of pushback you've gotten, and I would imagine maybe the standard form. So when you think of a parrot, you think of something that can repeat words but doesn't take into account the meaning of words, just repeat sequences of words. And in fact, you say in the paper that LLMs are, I think this is a quote, stitching together sequences of linguistic forms observed in fast training data according to probabilistic information about how they combine, and stochastic, that's kind of probabilistic, I guess, is what it refers to anyway, but without any reference to meaning. That's a quote from the paper. And, you know, LLMs, I think there's a sense in which they do have a system for representing meaning. You know, they locate words in multidimensional vector space. Now, to imagine like the two-dimensional version of that, like if you were graphing animals and you went and one axis was speed, that was the vertical axis, and another axis was degree of lethality, and you wanted to graph like a donkey and a tiger. Well, the tiger would be high on both of those. The donkey would be low on both, closer to the, you know, zero point. And these things, they graph words with thousands of dimensions that seem to reflect aspects of the meaning. I think some people would say, maybe you wouldn't. In any event, as a result, you know, like tiger and lion, those words are close to one another, relatively close to one another in this semantic space, much closer than either of them is to a word like bulldozer and so on. So some people would say that is a system of representing meaning, and it's one of the reasons that some of us find it useful, because it is, you know, unlike the old form of Google search, the original form, it is like a semantic search. You're not looking for words that have to appear in the document that you want to be unearthed. You just have to characterize what the contents of the, what kind of contents you want to find, and that works. So what is your response to that?
So, all right. So the first of all, Stochastic Paris, the paper, refers back to Bender and Kohler 2020, which is where we developed the argument that language models are models of the distribution of bits of worm forms in text, and not models of what anything means. There's no representation of communicative intent. When you use one of these things to synthesize text, you get something that we can make sense of, but doesn't represent anything that any entity was trying to say or trying to communicate. Now, what you're describing is sometimes called distributional semantics, and it's the idea that words that mean similar things are used in similar ways. And so they're going to co-occur with similar other sets of words. And that's how you get in the vector space lion and tiger being near each other. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that the model knows that they're both felines, that the model knows that they're both wild animals, that the model knows that they're both carnivores, et cetera, right? That's none of that. It's just that they are used around other words. And this representation of words in terms of what other words they co-occur with is extremely powerful. And in fact, has been being used to improve language technology for a long time, and with sort of increasing prevalence through the 2010s. Right, this the neural nets and vector space representations sort of took the field of NLP by storm through the 2010s. That was already true in search engines before people put a chat interface over it. So you can already say, use the keywords that the user put in and mm-hmm. find documents that involve words that are similar in the vector space to those keywords. You don't mm-hmm. have to have the chat interface. You don't have mm-hmm. to have the fancy.
I mean, it wasn't originally true of search engines, but you're right. They had been evolving. You're right.
I would never say evolving, but yes, people have been incorporating that into the technology.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But I always want to locate the agency with the people building and selling and choosing to use the technology and not with the technology.
Okay. That's like a John Searle.
And I'm sick and tired of being compared to Searle, who, by the way, was a sex pest and an asshole. All right.
I wasn't comparing you along that semantic dimension. Anyway, we don't need to get in, but there's this famous Chinese room argument as to why he said AIs can't understand things. But
yes,
and what he said is, to the extent there's understanding, it lies in the people who would program something that, say, could convert Chinese into English or something, but not in the program. That was the analogy I meant.
Yeah, and also it was an extremely othering way of making the argument. In Bender and Kohler, we have a thought experiment involving a deep sea octopus. And the point that we're making there, people say, oh, it's just the Chinese room again. And it's not, because Searle was saying, imagine you've got the system already built mm-hmm. and you've got a person who's using the system, who is receiving, you know, slips of paper with text in a language they can't read, which Searle mm-hmm. assumes that nobody can read Chinese, where obviously plenty of people can read Chinese, and then following instructions to output another slip, right? But the system is already created. The point that we're making in Bender and Kohler is that language models are only ever exposed to the form of language. And so the only system they can build up through this process that gets called training is a system that manipulates form. There's no access. You cannot expect a system to build a representation of something that is not in the input data. And the meaning is not in the input data. We experience it as being in the input data when we read text in a language that we know, but that's because we're making sense of it. We know the linguistic system. We have a shared common ground with people that we can project onto the text.
Yeah, but I'd say two things. One is we don't really know everything that's going on inside them. I'm not talking about sentience. I'm saying we don't really know what all the structures of information processing there are that are going on. And
yes, we do. Yes, we do. It's
no, we
continually
don't.
Predicting what's the likely next word. That's all it is. And everything else is just projection.
No, but I mean, we don't know. In fact, the multi-vector mapping, semantic mapping, is something that at first we did not realize it was doing. It invented.
Oh, no, that's bullshit. I'm sorry. That's absolutely bullshit.
That's it not. Is.
Look, that's
but I'm just saying, yeah, like, so if you're trying to. Okay, there's this, just to say this, like, this is not. To say that you don't, it is inventing as a thing is attributing first. It's doing the anthropomorphizing work of saying what the technology is actually doing. If you're suggesting that learning and embedding space is the same thing as constructing a meaning space in a similar way that humans do that, or that it came up with the kind of scheme whole cloth, is a misunderstanding of the learning operation. And so the thing, the kind of meme that I think you're getting at that is, I think, very silly is when people who are boosters say that we don't know how the thing works. We know the general principle of what a neural network architecture is doing. We know what the transformer architecture is doing. If they're saying we don't know how it's doing that, what they're suggesting is, we don't know which neuron activations or which piece or which layer or whatever are in which these particular concepts are quote unquote located. It is kind of taking the metaphor from neuroscience to the extreme. It's effectively saying, like, okay, in the brain, we don't know where, speech is located or wherever. That is, first, it's taking the metaphor, to a ridiculous end. And it's suggesting that there's kind of a mode of interpretability of the numbers, the very large matrices, in such a way that you're saying, oh, this is where in those numbers, this concept is located. And when you say it like that, it is very ridiculous saying, like, I don't know where in the matrix the concept of the meaning of life is located. That's effectively the kind of analog of what's being said. The principle of the sequence to sequence prediction is the same. It is, and there's added steps if you're talking about quote unquote reasoning models in which they effectively stop it at a particular training point and give it an intermediate prompt. And to suggest that it is doing anything but is dishonest. So I think the real kind of thing is to back up and wait. And when we hear the kind of phrase, we don't know how it works, what is actually being said there? Is it say that what they're effectively saying is that this is working in a way that's non-deterministic. Because it's non-deterministic, there are no ways to sort of tweak this pattern in such a way that will lead to something that is of a preferable outcome. That's why technologies like reinforcement learning with human feedback have been helpful in nudging towards, let's say, non-racist outcomes, or not suggesting, not nudging children to suicide or whatever the hell that the things are doing. And that's effectively what they're saying. But to suggest that we don't know how it's working mathematically or we don't know how the math works, that's patently silly and patently ridiculous. And it's granting the math agency in which there's areas in which it does not belong.
Okay, I think I should explain what I'm saying if you think it's patently silly. I'm saying that the way these things were set up is they said And look, I may personify the machine or something in the course of this for the sake of efficiency. Sorry, but this is the basic idea as I understand it. They said to the machine, like, look, you are going to use to represent each word, technically each token, each word, a series of numbers separated by commas. In other words, a very long vector. It didn't invent that part, no. But it did say, we're going to let the machine decide what those numbers are. It's going to fill in all those blanks. And similarly,
actually true.
Can I just finish? Can I just finish? And we said, then there are these things that are neurons, and there are connections between them that we call weights to determine how much influence has. Blah, blah, blah. They spelled the whole thing out, and yes, they developed the architecture of the math, and we understand the architecture. And then we said, now fill in these numbers, all these numbers, through trial and error in a way that allows you to get better at predicting how the text will be completed, given the first part. We did say all that, but we didn't say, and we want these numbers to represent aspects of the meaning of the word or characteristics of the meaning of the word. We didn't say that. And in fact, as I understand it, it took a little while to realize that it was doing that. Now, if you think that's false, let
yes,
me know.
It's false. Go look at Milukov et al. 2013, which is the Word to Vec paper, mm-hmm. which is the first really famous implementation of this idea using the so-called neural network architecture. Mm-hmm. Right. And the idea here is by building a system where words are represented by vectors, very high, that ends up getting boiled down to a lower dimensional space, but initially very high dimensional vectors. And the task that the system is being used for is predict the likely next word, mm-hmm. right? And then each time it gets it wrong, adjust the weights inside the neural network, adjust ultimately the vectors. Then the result is a representation of the words, where words that are used in similar ways have similar meanings. And that idea goes back to the 1950s. All right. The idea of distributional semantics is that old. It's not.
You mean it's applied to the human mind?
No, the observation that words that mean similar things occur in similar contexts in collections of text.
Oh, yeah.
Goes
yeah,
back to the 1950s.
Right.
And that fact about text mm-hmm. is what leads to word vectors, where if you develop the word vector through a system of calculating a likely next word and then updating the weights if the thing is wrong, mm-hmm. those word vectors will be similar for words that occur in similar contexts in the text. It's just an implementation of an idea from the 1950s.
I agree with all that, yes.
And I mean, and just in terms of this, I mean, there's nothing particular about the neural network that seemed to make it brain-like, right? I've trained language models before. I did one for my dissertation. It was a logistic regression, you know, and a logistic regression, it effectively said, you know, if you wanted to say that there's things that linked certain particular words together, what I did is that I showed the machine, examples of articles that are mention protest versus those that don't mention protest. Mm-hmm. And then, if you wanted to, the nice thing about a neural network, something like a logistic regression, is that it represents the tokens as, like, you can retrieve the coefficient matrix. And then I got to see the coefficient matrix, and I saw that, like, you know, words that, you know, kind of hung together, you know, protest, rally, Al Sharpton came up a lot, you know, like, these are, you know, so I mean, these are, you know, these, like, if you want to talk it from that, you know, just from a machine learning perspective, sure. I think, and I would also want to push back on your kind of, you know, saying, using the term in the anthropomorphizing language as a heuristic, because you did it in such a way, or I said in the way that I heard it, in such a way where it did obscure quite that, like it learned by itself, or it found this thing that the researchers were not intending. But that's not, you know, that's not the case. This is a learning algorithm in learning algorithms. That's the intention. And the intention is that it's possible that certain kinds of things with a, you know, in supervised, doing supervised learning, certain things are going to be attributed with a particular outcome because that outcome has been defined and that words, and I'm not a computational linguist, but, you know, I just sort of cosplayed one for my dissertation, but like, you know, but it was effectively, you know, doing it in such a way where certain things that are associated with a particular outcome then get associated with such. And attempts to portray a word embedding space, a large language model, whatever internal representations as anything other are dishonest.
Are you saying who's being dishonest? Who are the people who are being dishonest?
The people who are representing. I'm not calling you dishonest. I'm saying that people who represent it as such are being dishonest.
So any blog post from Anthropic is just riddled with this. Most of the stuff that comes out of OpenAI. It is occasionally when you see something where the lawyers have been involved, you can find something where they're actually giving descriptions of the systems that are not like just crawling with anthropomorphizing language. Mm-hmm. But if you look at any one of their blog posts, it's all that.
So let me ask you this, Emily. So I gave you my reason for thinking that when you wrote in the stochastic Paris paper that there was, you know, without any reference to meaning, I gave you my reason for thinking. I wasn't sure that was characterizing the situation exactly right. And you said, yeah, but it doesn't, I forget the language you used, something like, yeah, but it doesn't know the meaning or something like whatever language you used. What would have to be the case for you to say it did know? For example, would it have to be sentient or is there some sheerly just physical representation of information that could reside within the machine, even if it weren't sentient, that would constitute knowing or understanding or however you want to put it?
So in Bender and Kohler 2020, we actually give a specific definition of meaning and understanding, which is that meaning is a mapping between language and something outside of language. And understanding is the ability to go from the language. So if you've got a system where, you know, it's a voice-based system and I can say to it, you know, hey, system, turn on the lights, and it turns on the lights, then in a very thin sense and over a very narrow range, according to that definition, it is understood. The problem is that the output that comes out of these large language models, even if sometimes it is hooked up to a system, like I'm sure by now OpenAI has put in a component to detect when you're asking an arithmetic problem and then sends it off to a calculator because a large language model is an incredibly stupid way to try to do arithmetic, all right? That's a very solved problem on calculators and very efficient. So like if I say, you know, if I were to go to ChatGPT, which I never do, and ask an arithmetic question and back comes an actual answer because the system had detected that that was math and it did the thing, then yes, that little bit by my textual definition is understanding. But the problem is it's all dressed up in all of this other fluff, which plays on my ability to make sense of language and makes it seem like it's not just a machine that has been able to map what I said to some specific routine to carry out, but rather some thinking entity that has any right to use I, me pronouns that I'm interacting with.
You know, I was going to ask you this question. You said you never go to ChatGPT. Do you not use the chatbots, the LLMs yourselves in your lives? And if you do use them, how do you use them? But do you not use them at all?
I do my very best to avoid reading any synthetic text or consuming any synthetic media. I am not interested in reading something that nobody said, that nobody wrote.
I just check how bad they are at things mostly. If I'm like, okay, I hear it's good at coding. Maybe I should try that. And Never really gotten anything back. I mean, it's just, I mostly do periodic checks. One thing they did improve on one thing where it was like, show me what my citations are. And I guess it went to my Google Scholar page or whatever. And then they did an end run around Zotero, I guess. But I mean, I really don't find, you know, any use for them in my everyday work.
I mean, what I've found valuable is if there's something I just know nothing about, I mean, like theories about why Rome fell or something, I find it a much more efficient way to just get a sense for the landscape because, you know, it's like having an actual expert that you can interrogate. And,
There's no expert there.
I don't know.
And you're not getting
it's
a sense of the landscape.
Than any, and than any other option I have. I definitely can't summon an expert on Rome.
Go to the library. Talk to a librarian.
Yeah, but it's
you
so
have
much
options.
Slower. It's so much slower.
Oh, and I think you have to go out in the world and talk to people. Like, you're missing out on so much there. And on top of that, you're getting a fake view of a fake landscape.
I would also say that the kind of thing in which, and, you know, like, the kind of thing about it is, look, if I'm going to look up something in particular, I'm not going to be looking like why Rome fell. I'm an Arab Coptic trans woman. If I want to learn about like Coptic morphology or something, I'll probably go to Wikipedia because I don't know what the hell ChatGPT will do. Where I want to talk about something that's about like the history and the interrogation of kind of the particulars of you know, this kind of area of, let's say, queer people in Egypt, I don't think that's going to be represented in a particular way. And I don't want it to be kind of classed up to quote unquote bias, because I think that constrains it to a very silly kind of aspect of it. There's a good moment in a book by Wahini Vara called Searches, in which she intersperses some elements of the chapters with kind of like responses, you know, and in one point she says something like, who are the most important artists, you know? She's like, has these kind of conversations with chatbots, but it's like, and specifically ChatGPT, and she effectively says something like, you know, name like the top five most influential artists that have something to say technology. I think they're all men. And she's like, oh, could I, like, is there any women? And it's sort of like, and the kind of thing that, and I would say even amongst that of itself is like, that itself is like, the reason I don't want to constrain this to bias, because the solution for bias is let's collect more data. And I just refuse that kind of, you know, kind of surveillance and what I think is often community knowledge. Some of those things that I want to learn about are not going to be learned, you know, at the drop of the hat. It's going to be engaging community. And it doesn't even have to be talking to a librarian. I'm also a bit antisocial. I'm autistic. I don't like to like interact with people many times, but I can look at a text. I can look at the reference list. I think those kinds of practices that we learn from information literacy and library sciences and librarians, those are critical to learn for people. And what I see, what we see in schools, the kind of drive to use these tools as something that is authoritative. I asked chat, I did this. That is ruining the kind of ability to have an informed public, to have a kind of populace that is well suited for the project of democratic decision making. And that itself is an issue. We need more friction. We need more slowness. And if we're not doing that, then we're missing some of the most important things that we can be doing as members of a democratic society.
Yeah. Speaking of bias, I want to give you a chance to talk about something other than chat bots, because I've kind of steered the conversation in that direction. There are other manifestations of machine learning that you've both thought about a lot. So, for example, you know, using machine learning to, I don't think you get into this in the book, but it's the kind of, well, predictive AI broadly, right? Like trying to guess like which people are most likely to be criminals based on these various characteristics. Even just, why don't you sort these resumes for me, right? And in that case, like the way the machine learning works is you show it historically a bunch of resumes that came in and then a bunch of resumes that were selected and said, just do that the way we did it. And if the way we did it had a bias to begin with, it was biased against names that sound like they're from a particular ethnic group or something, that bias will be perpetuated, right? And so I guess one, I want to give you a chance to say anything you want about this whole realm, like predictive machine learning and so on. But in that realm, I guess my question would be, so basically the problem predated AI, but AI is perpetuating it. And is it your view it's actually making it worse? I mean, I can imagine in an ideal world, if you're conscious of the bias, you could create a machine that would actually like not do it, right? I mean, you
well,
could.
No, actually. We've both worked on this quite a bit, but if you have a small constrained problem, and if you're working at a scale where you can actually document the data that you're using, mm-hmm. then you are in a position to understand the bias in the data and decide whether or not decide how to mitigate the bias. But there's no such thing as an unbiased data set or an unbiased system. There is, however, a big difference between automatically filter these resumes for the ones that look most likely to be a successful candidate. And there it's very clear that you want to make sure that the markers of successful candidate are not historical bias, but actually the properties you're really looking for. And mm-hmm. the other example you gave, which is decide which of these people is most likely to be a criminal based on characteristics, because that's an ill-formed question, right? Whether or not someone is a criminal is not a property of the person, but it's a combination of laws and actions, and also like actions both by the person who ends up being considered criminal and by other people around them. All right. So that is just an ill-formed mapping from input to output. And I think one thing that has been exacerbated recently is, first of all, this idea that, oh, we should just get very large data sets and therefore it's going to be unbiased because it's too big to be biased. Bullshit. But also that any time you can do statistics and go from any input to any output, that that's a reasonable thing to do. Here's mm-hmm. a data set. It's got a bunch of characteristics of people, and one of them is whether or not they were considered criminal. Well, I'm going to build a statistical model to predict that and say that, therefore, I can tell if someone's criminal based on the length of their nose. All right.
The I forget whether, do you mention Palantir in the book? Whether you do or not, I'd encourage you to say anything you have to say about them.
I mean, that's a terrible operation. I don't know if we mentioned them by name, but I mean, I think we do mention Peter Thiel in the book. And I mean, any kind of elements in which there's data, you know, data fusion being leveraged against people, especially people who are amongst the most marginalized society. That's quite awful. I mean, we do talk about military technology to some degree in the mm-hmm. opening, but I mean, that's something that we could, you know, have other texts about. And there have been others who've talked about organizations like Palantir. One of them is Petra Mulder, who wrote the book "The Walls Have Eyes." That's all about kind of automated policing and militarization, mm-hmm. especially at borders. And so, you know, it's worth talking about that. And I think, you know, the scope of the book tends to, I mean, we're thinking about this industry writ large, but there's much to say on all of that as well.
Yeah. Now, was this your original entree into the whole field, paying attention to this kind of predictive policing and so on, or whatever it's called, or... Mm-hmm.
I mentioned earlier I was doing machine learning before it was AI in 2011.
And I've been running a professional master's program in computational linguistics since the early 2000s and working on societal impacts of language technology since the mid 2010s.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as a linguist, let me ask you this idea of multidimensional mapping, semantic mapping, that has long been one theory, right, of how the brain does it. I mean, we don't really understand all that much about what goes on in the brain, right?
So I am not a neurolinguist, but mm-hmm. I think that the distributional hypothesis, the idea that you can tell something about what a word means by what other words it shows up next to, is very old. It shows up in Firth, 1957. I don't think he's the first one. So what that means about what's happening inside of people's brains, like I said, I don't do that kind of science, so I don't have anything to say about it. But the fact that you have statistical models that we can use to model which words occur with which other words, turn up a representation of words that appear in similar things are similar to each other, is 0% surprising. It's effective. Yeah. It's useful in terms of like making better automatic transcription and making better search, like you were saying, not chatbots, but the like, you know, instead of keyword, sort of fuzzy keyword. But it's not surprising.
Yeah, I guess my guess would have been not that the human brain really does distributional semantics, not that that's the relevance to this subject so much as that the machines, if you view them, if you think, as you don't, that they are building, that there are inside the machine some features that are comparable to human brain, I think the idea would be that those features were kind of reverse engineered from the surface level You know, from the distributional sure. semantic
that's
properties.
Part of the fantasy, but it's a fantasy. And I actually do need to get going.
Okay. Yeah, so your last word is that it's a fantasy?
Yeah, it's a fantasy. And as Alex was pointing out earlier, it's a fantasy that is sort of built on and re-inscribed every time we use anthropomorphizing language to describe these systems. And every time we buy into the metaphor that a particular set of equations is a neural net.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for taking the time to both of you. And the book is The AI Con. And the podcast, are you enjoying the podcast?
Yeah, I like listening to it too.
You must have like a cult following, because I don't know of anything quite like it. Do you have a cult following?
We have a lot of fans.
Yeah, we have a lot of fans. And also it's been a great sense to sort of create a locus of community. People who felt like they were the only ones and everyone around them has somehow jumped off the deep end right. with this so-called AI stuff, find our podcast and realize they're not alone. And that's been one of the best things about it.
Yeah. Okay, well, good. We'll keep it up. Thanks a lot for the time.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.